I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, recently, late-night comedian Stephen Colbert was canceled by CBS. Many suspect it was because of his criticism for President Donald Trump. On social media, Trump warned other late-night hosts Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon that they could be next. Is comedy, a vanguard of free speech, in trouble in America? We're going to hear from Daily Show correspondent Michael Costa. And later on The Source, in 1968, the students at Edgewood High School staged a pivotal protest, a walkout, that helped focus the public debate about the chronic racial educational inequity in the United States. While there was slow progress made in school finance in Texas, there are still underfunding issues in public schools across the state. Who follows in the footsteps of the walkout? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
This is Ashley Alvarado, President and CEO of Texas Public Radio. The recent defunding of public media was a serious blow to TPR and stations across the country. But when we turned to you, you rose to the challenge, and your response was extraordinary. Thanks to your generosity, our emergency fundraising drive was a powerful reminder of the strength of our community. You showed just how deeply you value independent journalism, classical music, and the role TPR plays in bringing us together. Defunded? Yes. Defeated? Never. But our work is far from over. You can still give at tpr.org/resiliency, and every gift strengthens our future. Thank you for being the heart and the hope of TPR.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Comedy is having a constitutional moment right now in these United States. Joke tellers and court jesters are traditionally the voices of dissent. They use stand-up to stand up for free speech by frequently testing the limits of free speech, which is something that becomes limited and contracted in an authoritarian government. Satire exposes hypocrisy. It can mobilize public awareness, and it presents an uncomfortable public challenge to those in power. The controversy around Stephen Colbert's late-night show cancellation illustrates this tension. Colbert had been critical of President Donald Trump and his own network owners for paying a $16 million settlement to Trump over a case that in itself was an assault on freedom of the press. Mainstream satire like South Park continues to confront Trump head-on with irreverent, vulgar dialogue and bold political commentary depicting him literally with demons and many man parts. So what do comedians make of this moment? We're joined by Michael Costa. He is the senior correspondent for The Daily Show, and he will be performing in San Antonio on Friday at the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts with his Lucky Loser tour. Lucky Loser is also the title of his recently published memoir. And Michael Costa, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me, and what a poignant and spot-on introduction of what's happening right now.
Right, so I wanted to ask you about, you know, how do you feel about this particular moment?
Well, comedians, in my opinion, get in trouble when they write a joke or perform a joke with the goal of this is important. I think the goal is always to be funny. And the goal is always to entertain. And if it just so happens that we're holding a mirror up to society or criticizing those in power, well, then that's even better because one, you're laughing, and two, we've made a good point. So I know in my comedy for 20 years, and I know here at The Daily Show the last 30 years, we're just trying to call out the BS first. And if it happens to be important, and particularly important in this moment, well, even better.
Right. You're telling jokes. You're not doing a TED Talk.
I'm telling jokes. I'm not doing a TED Talk. But when we are at our most effective, they seamlessly kind of go in and out of each other. I always say I have the best job ever. Because if I said something stupid or offensive, I go, relax, I'm a comedian. But if I say something smart, I say, sometimes I do journalism.
Yeah, that is a slippery slope sometimes. So we have heard, because of this moment right now, that it's been reported, it was in the Washington Post, that mainstream political comedians are increasing self-censorship to avoid potential legal or political repercussions. Have you seen anything like that?
Not here at The Daily Show, thankfully. You know, we have been around for 7 different executive administrations, 8 presidential elections. We're not feeling it, and we're going for it. I noticed it on the news, though. I noticed just recently when Trump's caddy cheated for him and dropped the ball so he could have a better lie. I mean, a full-on blatant cheat. I watched the morning news, and they were afraid to even say the word cheat. And that is what's scary about headed towards fascism or authoritarianism, is the media starts to self-censor. And let me tell you this. We have a leader who cannot take a joke, has no sense of humor. Rarely do we see him laugh, if ever. And I encourage anyone to go back to the history books, look at the regimes of where a leader can't take a joke and has tried to silence the media and its critics. It doesn't usually end well, and it doesn't head in the best direction.
Let me ask you real quick. You're a sports guy. You're a former professional tennis player. You've done, you were doing ESPN with And the Crowd Goes Wild. So sports guys, if someone cheats in golf, just as blatantly as that, what does that tell another sports guy about that individual's character?
Well, yeah, right? It says a lot. It says a lot. And look, we've all cheated at golf. I mean, you know, if you're playing recreational golf, you kick the ball out of the rough into the fairway. We've all cheated at golf. Trump cheating, I believe that was a casual game. I also know that he constantly claims he wins tournaments, so I'd love to see his behavior during those. But here's what I hated about that, David. He didn't improve his lie. It was clear the people working for him were told to do the dirty work and drop the fresh ball for him. That's what I think is soft. That's what I don't think this alpha male president actually is that. I think it's fake. I think it's soft. And I'll tell you what right here, David. When I cheat at golf, Costa cheats at golf. I don't send somebody else to do my cheating for me.
I cheat at putt-putt. Is that any better?
That's fair.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, at least you do. I mean, if you were Trump, you would have somebody else do the cheating for you. That's weak.
So back to the point here about comedians in this moment and free speech and being able to have the freedom in America to be able to say whatever you want and stand up, just trying to be funny. Is it fair to expect so much of comedians that they have to bear this? Because, you know, comedians, I mean, are they philosophers? Are they really equipped to be the sages of society?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one we get frustrated with. And Jon Stewart says all the time, hey, would you ask that question to a politician who we've elected? Would you ask that question to a CEO of a publicly funded Fortune 500 company? No, it's not fair to hold us to this. Most comedians are idiots. And most comedians have ketchup stains on their shirt and, you know, divorced multiple times and are absent fathers. I'm not saying that's what I am, but I'm saying this isn't like the upheld version of society comedians. And in some strange reason, because of that, because we know they're human, because we see comedians as fallible, because they talk in a self-deprecating way, we actually trust them. And that's what's wild. That's the most common thing that I hear from people when they stop me on the subway or on the street, is they say, thank you, we get our news from you and we trust you. And I look behind me saying, who are they talking to? I'm a comedian.
Yeah, but in a way, you're the canary in the coal mine. If they start shutting down comedians, then we're all in trouble.
That's true. And you know, this is America. We're the country in the First Amendment, the first thing they wrote down, the very first thing 270 years ago, where they wrote down the five freedoms in the First Amendment, which was speech, press, assembly, petition your government, and religion. And if we are attacking the First Amendment, that is the foundation and the core of this country. And let me also say this, David. Mm-hmm. I advocate for free speech whether I agree with it or not. That's the whole point. That's the hard part. That's the hard part of the First Amendment. You have to allow it even if you don't necessarily agree with what's being said.
And that's no joke. And Michael Costa, thank you so much. Senior correspondent for The Daily Show at the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts on Friday. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1968, the students of Edgewood High School here in San Antonio staged a pivotal act of protest, a walkout that helped focus the public debate about chronic racial education inequality, inequity in the schools and across the country, here in San Antonio and across Texas. The story of that protest is told in a new documentary film called The Walkout. It will premiere on Saturday, August 2nd at the Edgewood Performing Arts Center, the Edgewood Fine Arts Theater. And we're joined by Katie Best Richmond, the producer of the documentary and the program manager for the H.E. Butt Foundation's Know Your Neighbor program. Katie, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
Al Kaufman is with us. He is a civil rights attorney, law professor, specializing in education and voting rights. Al Kaufman, always great to have you on.
Wonderful to be here.
And we're also joined by Manuel Garza. He was a walkout participant, and he is in the documentary and a lifelong activist. And Manuel, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
So, Katie, if you could tell me, why does the H.E. Butt Foundation, what is Know Your Neighbor program?
Absolutely. So at the Know Your Neighbor program, we believe that by listening to the stories of our neighbors and sharing those, we're able to create a more whole view of what life is like in San Antonio for everyone that lives here, because you get really different experiences depending on the neighborhood that you live in. And so we try to find ways to share those stories and gather people so that we can have conversations about really important things affecting our lives together.
And you said this was a this is part of San Antonio's history, but also the history of the West Side, Edgewood, that area?
Absolutely. And it's a story that everyone in San Antonio should know, because what happened at Edgewood impacts every single person that goes through a public school in Texas.
All right. So, Manuel Garza, you were part of this. You were a student at the time. What year were you at Edgewood?
Well, the walkout was in 68, but we actually started, you know, and I was a junior in 68. We started actually doing the planning the year before. We went through a process, but it was 1968 when we did the walkout, May 16th, 1968.
And what were y'all thinking at the time? So what were the conditions at this school that prompted, like, this is intolerable, we're going to have to walk out?
Well, again, we went through a process, and the first step that we did, you know, again, I was my sophomore year, we had that. I was in the band, so we had a band practice and stuff. And
what'd you play?
I played the trombone.
All right, and so you were in the band,
and so we decided to, because she said, well, we need new uniforms, we need new instruments, we need an actual band hall where we can practice.
So things that other schools had.
Yes, but. Little did we know that the junior class had been going to Outward Bound, you know, which was in San Marcos, to be acclimated to going to college, you know, so that's what that was about. And so that same summer, they came back, saw the facilities at Texas State University, now it's called Texas State, Southwest Texas University, that's where the classes were being held. And so they saw the differences. They said, we don't have this in Edgewood, we don't have this in... So they wrote a letter with, you know, to the principal, Mr. Mangum, asking for some things to be changed. Nothing happened. And so at the same time, there was in Bexar County, in actually the ACOG area, the 12-county area, there was a council of student councils that would meet, periodically. I don't know, I remember how often, but they would meet. And so that's where the discussion with the other high schools, how come this high school has this and we don't have that? So that's where some of the ideas were generated from. When the juniors were going to be seniors, when they were going to be seniors, they again, had gone to San Marcos and wrote it down. But this time we did it differently. We went to our homeroom classes, the first period class. We gathered, information, demands, suggestions, whatever you want to call it. Demands, it's a good word. But we collected about a good inch and a half of paper, because it was all written. We didn't have, Xerox machines. The mimeograph machine, we could have access to it. So, Luis Martinez, who was the senior class president, he turned that in. We never saw it back from Mr. Mangum. At our annual...
So these are like a list of demands?
Right. And so we're going to have our student council convention, and we organize it just like our national conventions. All the homerooms would send a representative. And so Evangelina Carrion, who was a senior at the time, she was part of the Upward Bound. And so she said, this time we got to do it differently. Last time we turned in a one page of request to Mr. Mangan, nothing happened. This time, we turned in a good document. We need to get our parents, we need to get the community involved. And so Mr. Mangum was listening to the convention in the intercom, and he walks in and he says, this convention is over. Rosendo Gutierrez, who just passed away last month, little short guy, turns around and says, no, it's not. And so we started the process. Tony Molina was the student council president. The leadership of the student council went and met at Tony Molina's to figure out what to do. And then we had another meeting with our parents at Robert Claiborne's house, who's a ROTC commander, and Mr. Mangum. And again, he turned down the request. So the third time that we met was at St. Anne's Catholic Church. And there, Willie Velasquez was there, Mayo, Nacho Perez, Mario Compián, they were all there. And so Willie says, tomorrow at 10 o'clock, we walk out. So we walked out.
So the conditions, there were, the infrastructure.
The infrastructure, the building was horrible.
It was broken down.
No air conditioning, no heaters. Mr. Gutierrez, Ben Gutierrez, who was our English teacher, Mr. Mangum called him one time and said, and this was during the head of winter, and the middle of winter. And so he says, Mr. Gutierrez, I need to talk to you. So he walked over there and says, yes, Mr. Mangum, what do you need? He said, I need for you to take off your coat so the students won't think it's cold. Now, the chemistry teacher was down the hall and heard him say that. Mr. Mangum, can you please come over here? I said, yeah, hold on, I'll be right over. So then he goes over there, the flask for the lever, the science teacher, was full of water, and it was frozen. The water was frozen. He said, that's how cold it was. Alfredo Aleman, one of the guys that worked, graduated the year before the walkout, and we had a literary, publication that we put together. And so his point was the winter ghost of Edgewood. And so it was a very good little poem that he wrote about the conditions of the school. And that we're talking about the facility itself. We didn't have access to the restrooms. They would lock the restrooms.
Why would they lock the restrooms?
No smoking in the restroom. stuff like that, But it was the conditions, again, like I said, the band wanted new uniforms, new band instruments, a new band hall.
So what did you make of this situation there? I mean, so you're talking about the principal, Mr. Mangum?
Mr. Charles Mangum, yeah.
And, I mean, he didn't decide to underfund the school. He was basically a functionary of
right. The school. When the band went over to the superintendent's office to ask to talk to the superintendent, there was 15 of us that walked over there. And they told us that we had not followed procedure, that we needed to go back and talk to Mr. Mangum. So we went back, and Mr. Mangum was at the door of the school, says, come on in, I need to talk to you guys. And so so as soon as we walked in and got settled down, he started talking, and before you know it, he was crying. And he said, you have embarrassed me. You have embarrassed me in front of the superintendent. And Lupe Pruneda, who was one of the trombone players, her dad was one of the, you know, concerned parents organizers, and the deacon at, you know, at San Agustin Catholic Church. And so Lupe says, Mr. Mangum, stop crying. Just get us what we need.
And we so did, and we walked out. I thought you said he was crying. I was thinking he's crying because he failed you. He's doing the best he can.
No, because we had embarrassed him.
You'd embarrassed him. Okay. So was that the intent of the walkout? Was to not just embarrass him, but embarrass the school district?
No.
What was when you said we're going to do the walkout? What did you think that was actually doing?
Well, we had talked about a lot of things, and we had uncovered a lot of things, and one of course was the school funding, that was inadequate. There was no school fighting equity at all. And so that was one of the major things. We've also uncovered other things that were going on by the administration. The superintendent was more than double dipping. And so his salary, the construction company that built the schools, even the landscaping company clean up the schools and stuff, and also the VOE program, which was you go to school half a day to work. Well, he was a referral company for that. All of that changed after the walkout. So all of that changed. And, of course, some things improved.
Sure.
Like, you know, bilingual education, Jose Cardenas came in and put a good program on bilingual education. Bobby Cardenas, you know, put together the COPS program, which trained graduates to be teachers at St. Mary's University. So there's a lot of things that came out of it. You know, our school, you know, Edgewood High School, after the walkout, there were some improvements, physical improvements to the auditorium. It served as a cafeteria auditorium. But, you know, they put paintings on the walls, but they were all, you know, Texas Ranger killing Indians, you know, stuff like that. But anyway,
I'm going to get to this point, and the fact that the school, Edgewood, was underfunded was not a bug of the system, it was a feature of the system. This is how the system was designed.
Correct.
Because of the way that Texas had property taxes, the way that school districts were carved up, Edgewood ISD's small school district, it had limited availability to raise money through property taxes. Correct. Because this was a property poor area. Did y'all have any understanding of that at the time?
There was some mention of it, and of course, you know, The reality of it is, you know, there was over 60 school districts at one time in Bexar County. And as they started consolidating the school districts, they kept leaving Edgewood out because it was a poor tax.
Certain, and other ones like Harlandale and,
yeah.
You know.
And so, but, you know, so we knew about that, but also we knew about the more impactful things that were going on that we learned from the janitors, we learned from the cafeteria workers, things that were going on that, you know, we weren't aware of that. Ms. Alberta Sneed was a, you know, parent organizer. Demetrio Rodriguez, of course, was the the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit.
Yeah, Rodriguez v. San Antonio, yes. ISD.
And a neighbor of mine just lived two blocks away. So it took an effort to get things going. So I handed to both of them, Mr. Rodriguez and Mrs. Neat. Mrs. Neat was actually a lieutenant for Emma Tenayuca during the 1930, pecan sale strike. So I learned a lot from her.
A lot about organizing, about community people organizing. Power.
Yes.
And how to negotiate. And,
yes.
And so we're going to take a break here. When you come back, we're going to hear from Al Kaufman about the legal side of this argument and this debate to fight for, a just way of educating our students. But, our phone lines are open if you want to call in. If you were part of the walkout, you heard about the walkout, you walk in the steps of the walkout, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The walkout is a documentary that will air, that will screen for the first time on Saturday at Edgewood Performing Arts Center. More on that when we come back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. One of the most storied episodes in San Antonio's fight for equality and civil rights is the walkout at Edgewood High School, 1968. Students were fed up with the underfunding of their schools, the falling down infrastructure, teachers who were not certified to teach, the lack of classes for advanced placement to allow them to enter and excel at universities. They did the big walkout. It was a stunner in San Antonio. Nothing like that had happened before, and it is remembered today. And we're talking about those stories. We're telling stories of the walkout, but there is a new documentary film that will be premiering about this, telling the story. It's a beautiful film. It will be premiering on Saturday, August 2nd at the Edgewood Performing Arts Center, which is at the Edgewood Fine Arts Theater, and that's at 5 p.m. And right? Correct?
It's at 2 p.m.
2 p.m. 2 p.m. Sorry. Okay. So at 2 o'clock. And then there's also an opportunity to talk about it, platica, and meet with some of the people who are actually in the film and tell stories and help inspire the next generation to keep people walking in the footsteps of the walkout and demand equality and better treatment and education opportunities. We're joined right now by Katie Best Richmond. You just heard from her. She's the producer of the documentary and program manager for the H.E. Butt Foundation's Know Your Neighborhood program, which is overseeing these types of storytelling events. Al Kaufman is with us, civil rights attorney, law professor at St. Mary's University, specializing in education and voting rights, constitutional law. And you just heard Manuel Gonzalez. Manuel Garza was a walkout participant, and he is in the documentary and a lifelong activist. So Al Kaufman, let's go to you. Since this became a legal battle after the walkout, how does that become something that translates into we got to go to court?
Well, the walkout generated interest all over the country, particularly in San Antonio. But let me say that the system was extremely bad, unequal, unfair, all for rich people for many years. It was designed to be like that. But to be honest, people in the school districts didn't really know that. They didn't really understand the system in general. So even though there were people in poor districts who couldn't really provide a good education for their students, some of it was lack of effort, but a lot of it was just lack of knowledge, because those people who designed the system and were benefiting from the system really didn't want the word to get out.
But at the time, the city fathers, the people who ran San Antonio, the Good Government League and these type of people, they saw the Mexican-American population as a resource of cheap labor for factories and other menial labor that we had in San Antonio. And the people who were calling the shots in San Antonio didn't see a benefit to be investing in education generally for this incredibly important, identity of San Antonio. They didn't want to invest in that area. Is that right?
I think that's right for sure. But they reflected some of the whole state philosophy. Certainly the leaders of San Antonio, the Good Government League, I researched them extensively. When my first lawsuit was against the city of San Antonio to get single-member districts. So the Good Government League was in pretty much control of everything. But they represented sort of the upper class and middle class white culture of San Antonio that was happy the way things were. And they were not going to go out of their way to help the poor Mexicanos on the west and south sides of San Antonio. But the walkout generated a lot of interest, and people got very involved. And that's one of the things that led to the filing of the lawsuit, the federal lawsuit in 1969. People like Willie Velasquez helped organize that. And a guy named Arthur Gotchman, a lawyer here in San Antonio, filed it. And they tried to convince the federal courts that this system was unconstitutional. There have been one or two cases around the country like that, but this was the most important one right out of San Antonio with San Antonio ISD versus Rodriguez. So that was to some extent a result of the interest. And of course, other things are going on at the same time. I mean, there was political activism all over the country because of the Vietnam War. The Raza Unida Party was getting developed and focusing on Mexican-American interest. So all these things were going on at the same time. The Edgewood walkout was a manifestation of that, but all pulled together to lead to the lawsuit and a lot of increase in knowledge of the system.
So let's talk about more about the times that we're, this 1968. Okay, what a turbulent time that was. But as you said, there was a lot of protest. We had the Vietnam protests going on, civil rights protests going on at the time. We had, you know,
Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy assassinated, yeah.
Yeah, right. And, you know, also gender equality was also important at the time. These are all happening simultaneously. There was a walkout in L.A., that was also, was that an, so Manuel, was that an inspiration, the L.A. walkout?
Yes, there was. There was a, their walkout was a month before. And Lanier High School was also a month before. But Lanier actually didn't walk out. They got some of their demands actually met. But it was all tied in, you know, people from Los Angeles, the organizers of the walkout, sending, you know, what you would call it, there's no email.
Yeah.
Western Union.
So you sent a telegram?
Yeah, a telegram, you know, congratulating the Lanier walkout students. So there was a connection. And so, but it's all about how it was organized. Again, the leaders, Mario Compián, José Gutiérrez, Willie, they were all tied into what was going on nationally. And so, yeah, there was a tie.
And so back to you, Al Kaufman, the filing a lawsuit. Okay, so there was the Rodriguez or SAISD versus Rodriguez, mm-hmm. and that was the lawsuit saying that education was a fundamental right that everyone should have. And but the idea, and that all the rights that we have, like the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, all these freedom of religion, if you don't have freedom of education, then these other rights basically are not able to be actualized.
Well, that's the argument that the plaintiffs made. They tried to convince the U.S. Supreme Court about that, and the Supreme Court said no. They said that education is not a fundamental right. It's not a basic constitutional right.
And because it's not enumerated in the Constitution.
That's right. The word is not there. The concept's not there. I was talking to some students from who came over to St. Mary's for a class. And I said, well, you know, also other words that aren't in the Constitution are marriage, contraception. There are all sorts of words that people think are extremely important are not in the Constitution, let alone political parties. But the Supreme Court decided that education was not a fundamental right because it wasn't specifically written in the Constitution. And of course, the argument of the plaintiffs was that it's fundamental to all the other rights. See, how can you really speak equally if you're not educated? How can you participate? How can you work with other people if you're not educated? But the Supreme Court wouldn't go there by a 5-4 decision. They decided that it wasn't a fundamental right. They also said that the system would not survive if they applied the highest level of scrutiny to the Texas system. In other words, if education was a fundamental right, then the Supreme Court would have to apply a very careful and strict construction to the Texas system. And they said under that system, Texas would fall, and also the school finance systems of almost all the other states would fall. So all of this came out in the case in 1973, 5-4 decision. Justice Marshall's dissent is a work of art, but nevertheless, we lost.
And so it gets kicked back to the state of Texas. In Texas, their education is mentioned in the state constitution. There, it's promised that all students will get an adequate education?
They say an efficient education, an efficient education. And that's been included to be adequate. If the word isn't adequate, isn't used, but general diffusion of knowledge is what they say. But Texas has this particular provision of the Texas Constitution guaranteeing the right to education and putting on the legislature the responsibility of designing an efficient system of free public schools.
So, but that system did not exist at that time, clearly.
It certainly didn't exist, but that's not the first constitutional right that's been violated by the state of Texas. But nevertheless, it was not. But the Texas Supreme Court, which you're getting to, and we filed the state case in 84.
It was Edgewood versus Kirby.
That was Edgewood versus Kirby.
10 years later, because they had to take care of it.
That's right.
It's 10 years later.
Some of the same people were involved. In fact, Demetrio Rodriguez was one of the plaintiffs in the Edgewood case. And the Texas Supreme Court found that the system did violate the Texas Constitution.
But they found that it did violate the Constitution, but they did not provide a remedy.
That's right. The Supreme Court said, we find it violates the law, but it's up to the legislature to come up with a system. And that's fairly common in the law. Usually the courts will not design the system. They'll just find it unconstitutional and send it back to the legislature.
So, and that's how we ended up with the system we have now?
It went back to the Supreme Court six more times.
Yeah.
But eventually, that's how we came up with what we have now, which, by the way, is much better than it was before the state lawsuit was filed.
Yeah.
Not equitable yet, but still better.
But still, I mean, public education in general over the state of Texas, and we find this out in the documentary, is underfunded compared to other states in the country. When you talk about the enormous power of the Texas economy and how much money is raised by the state of Texas, how little of it actually ends up in classrooms in Texas. And still there is disparity and inequality and things that are happening across the state. So, you know, how that works is complicated. And, you know, I mean, I can't even puzzle my way through how.
But Texas
works.
Violates both things. It was never an equitable system, never fair among its districts. And as a whole state, it was inadequate compared to the other states. So that's still a problem and will be as long as we don't want to pay taxes.
Okay. All right. Well, we got to take another break here. We're going to continue talking about The Walkout, and that is the name of a new documentary film about the 1968 Edgewood High School walkout, which was a pivotal act of protest. And then it helped really sort of crystallize a lot of thinking, focus the debate about what are we going to do about fixing the education system that we have in San Antonio, across Texas, across the country. That documentary will be premiering on Saturday, August 2nd at 2 p.m. at the Edgewood Performing Arts Center and at the Edgewood Fine Arts Theater. Our phone lines are open. If you want to call in, tell us if you were part of the walkout, if you heard about the walkout, what does education finance mean to you? Give us a call, 833-877-8255. I'm going to get Joe on the air when we come back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Walkout, a new documentary film telling the story of the 1968 Edgewood High School walkout that launched a movement to fix public education funding in the state of Texas, and that movement is still moving along. Who will be next to follow in the footsteps of the walkout? We need a new generation to step up. Give us a call. Talk about if you were part of the students, if you were there, remember this story, what does it mean to you? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Joe on the line. Hey, Joe, what do you know? You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a graduate of Kennedy High School, which is also the in the Edgewood ISD at the time. And I do remember the walkout. I graduated in 69 from Kennedy, and I was in college when I heard about the Rodriguez versus ISD or San Antonio ISD. Here's my question. Number one, why do we have like 16 different school districts in San Antonio, and how do we fix it? That's the biggest thing I need to know.
Joe, thank you for that call. And I think that is a seminal question that needs to be talked about. So let's go to the way school districts developed. It was an interesting way that they eventually kind of came together. But Al Kaufman, do you want to take that on?
Well, they developed just by each little community started its own school.
Right.
And then over time, they got larger and figured out that they had to consolidate to be able to run a school district. But then it became politics. There was like county politics to decide which districts were going to join with which districts. And the people who control the politics of the county control that as well. So they could sort of choose which areas were going to go into Alamo Heights, which into North Side, Northeast, and as well as the South Side district, South Sand, Harlandale, Edgewood. So that was a political battle within the counties. And there was a struggle. There were many struggles on it. But generally, the people who ran the politics of the county ran that too.
All right. And so, Emmanuel, you wanted to jump in on that?
Yeah. I mean, again, as Elma was mentioning, at one point, there were 60 school districts in the Bexar County. And they started consolidating, you know, the school districts because of economics. And Edgewood was not economically, you know, stable enough for them to include us. So we got left out. But it was about communities, you know, how the school districts were organized were communities. And so that's what happened. But to Joe's question, you know, how come, you know, we don't have one school district? Houston has it, Dallas has it, and so why not San Antonio? And so that's about consolidating. But as of now, I don't think that there's a real, you know, interest in doing that. From what I can tell, El, I don't know.
Let me say this: if there were one district for each county, the system would be much more equitable.
They have in places like New Mexico.
Yes, I think correct. Even in Florida has that too. They have one district for each county. I think there's been such a resistance to that, partially because of the pride of each school district and their high school, but also just the idea of keeping power.
The people in those districts want to control,
and they don't want people from the other side of town to go to their district.
But, you know,
well, it's also about, you know, voting rights has gotten a lot of Latinos elected to school districts and city councils, and giving that up, you know, is also an issue.
But you can still have single member districts inside a ISD.
It depends. It's there's rules to that as well.
But for a school district to link up with another school district, either that school district has to go bankrupt or violate the rules so bad that the state steps in and dissolves that school district. But typically what would happen is that you would have to, you've seen school districts consolidate. You look at consolidated school districts are all over the state of Texas, and usually that happens because of dire economic need. But you would have to have a vote from both school districts, and the people would have to decide to do that in mass. And like you said, there's the pride. I can't believe my high school, you know, like, you know, is going to go away, and that nostalgic pride stands in the way.
I think this film that HEB put together is going to be very important to try to pull a lot of interest and focus a lot of interest on these things in Bexar County. So I'm looking forward to seeing the
full
film.
We need to explain to people, because we hear that if you combine school districts, particularly two low property poor school districts, you don't really fix many problems. That they tell you that there's really not a lot of economic gain from that.
Well, that's actually not true. There is economic gain. It doesn't solve all problems, though. You know, the very large districts like Houston and Dallas have sub-districts and try to bring people in. And by the way, in Houston and Dallas, there are many districts. There's a larger interior district, but there are many districts in each one of those counties.
Right.
And I think it doesn't solve all the problems. I'm saying from a purely economic point of view, it makes more sense to have one district for each county. But still, you're always going to run into problems of democracy about whether each part of the city is going to be represented well, each school district is going to want to be represented, each school. So, I mean, it doesn't solve all the problems in the world, for sure.
All right, let's go.
To be equitable.
Yeah. Let's go to Henrietta. Henrietta, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. And I want to congratulate NPR for having this show on. I will be going Saturday to the premiere of the movie, and I'm sorry I was not living in Texas when this was taking part, but I know that I got a lot of the story from Adan Hernandez, who happened to be the artist of Blood In, Blood Out, all that beautiful art, but also Cheech Marin, Helen Mirren, Michael Ferrer, they buy his art, and he was told by artists here that gangster art would not sell, but he's the one that told me all the story, and I still have pain because it still continues in our school district, especially with the children that have learning disabilities or physical disabilities. They also discriminate against them. And also, they don't provide the teachers with enough teachers that have the knowledge. They'll just put anybody that knows nothing and does know very little to deal with children that have those disabilities. And I feel the pain because I know a lot of people that have physically been injured or harmed, uh-huh. and then the school district would not help them. But uh-huh. I love NPR, and
I have talked
with other people that still feel the pain, and they know that teachers would fall asleep and not need not enough toilet paper. And thank you.
All right, Henrietta, thank you for that. So to the point, so the walkout basically were students demanding higher standards, better quality teachers, advanced placement classes, because they knew that education, correct me if I'm wrong, Manuel, that they knew that education was their way up to upward mobility, right?
Correct. And you know.
And it was being deprived.
Right.
Their future was being stolen from them.
I mean, I can. When I enrolled to go to Edgewood High School, I had been doing a summer job. It was a combination grocery store, gas station, and cafe. And so I was working during the summer, then I was in the band. So when we started band practice, I told my boss, Mr. Galloway, that I had to, you know, coming in the afternoons because we had morning band practice. He said, no problem. When it came time to register for school, I had told him ahead of time, on this day, I'm not coming at all because I got, you know, registration, you know, I mean, band practice, then registration in the afternoon. So I said, okay. So the following day when I went to work, he told me, at the end of the day, you pick up your money. And I said, are you firing me? And he says, yeah, are you firing me because I'm Mexican? He says, well, Mexicans don't need to go to school. That's what he told me. And so if there's a desire, why we needed to, you know, move toward better education, that to me was an incentive for me in itself. I had been a straight-A student from, you know, elementary school through middle school. So to me, that was not what we were taught, not at home. You know, my parents, my grandparents.
You would go to the counselor and you would tell them you would want to go to a Ivy League school. They would say.
We didn't talk to our counselor till a week before he graduated.
So, yeah.
We didn't get that counseling.
Al Kaufman, you look at public education in Texas right now, public schools, traditional public schools, the majority of students that make up those schools are children of color, right?
Absolutely. Children of color and children of low income. So.
And so when you ask the question, why is the state of Texas underfunding public schools today? And you look at who are the children in those desks today, do you come up with an answer that basically traces back to the walkout?
A lot of it does. You're right. It's all over the state, by the way. It wasn't just
Edgewood.
Yes, right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, East
Texas. We had
54
walkouts.
Yeah, so 54 walkouts followed after.
Right.
Do you wonder about, like, who's going to continue walking out? Who's going to continue in your footsteps, Manuel?
Well, I've always worked with youth. So hopefully the work that I've done, you know, I continued mentoring, you know, college students, high school students. So, and they're all very engaged. So I'm encouraged. You know, my philosophy is that everybody leads. You just need to know where you're going and how to get there. But everybody's got that capacity to lead. So I've got a lot of, you know, I guess you could say trust of what's going to happen, you know, with our youth. I'm not a...
But the walkout continues.
The walkout continues.
Manuel Garza, he He was a walkout participant in 1968 in that documentary film, and a lifelong activist, Al Kaufman, civil rights attorney, law professor, specializing in education, voting rights at St. Mary's University. Katie Best Richmond is the producer of the documentary and program manager for the H.E. Butt Foundation's Know Your Neighborhood program at 2 p.m. On Saturday at the Edgewood Performing Arts Center at the Edgewood Fine Arts Theater. You can watch the walkout documentary, and it is worth watching. It is a beautiful film, well-produced. Thank you all for being in today. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.